You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
With the obvious exception of Plato's Phaedrus, really old books don't spend much time on technology. Perhaps the tools didn't change fast enough. Perhaps their writing materials were expensive enough that they didn't want to spend time on instrumental or transient matters. Perhaps the questions just never occurred to them. But sometime in the modern era, folks started to write about the ways that our tools change and the ways that new sets of tools change us for good and for ill. And one of those moments when those changes were doing the most harm or the most benefit we'll talk about as the hour rolls along, was the 19th century. Jeff Bilbro's new work, Words for Conviviality, explores some of the writers engaging with those changes and invites us to hold up those 19th century moments as mirrors to our own 21st century moment. And Christian Humanist Profiles is glad to invite him back on the show. Jeff, welcome back.
Thanks, Nathan. It's good to talk with you again.
Well, let's start with this book's title, because for most folks not named Jeff Bilbro, the word conviviality isn't one that we use on a regular basis. So tell us a story. Where in your reading did you run across that word, and what makes it a good point of departure for this book?
Yeah, that's a common question for sure. We need to bring conviviality back into our lexicon. So that's my humble effort. But the word comes, I mean, I get it from Ivan Illich, and my title is really just a riff on the title of his book, Tools for Conviviality. So I'm kind of zeroing in on words. But his basic use, I guess, of the term is kind of trying to elaborate on or unpack the Latin root so that we, you know, traditionally conviviality just means feasting together, eating together. But etymologically, it's more simply living together. And what does it mean to live together well? Yeah, I guess in a celebratory manner, but to live together and recognize that our lives are intertwined with those around us. And when he's talking about convivial tools, obviously it's a whole book, he talks at great length about this, but his basic argument is that convivial tools are not some sort of a regression to primitive tools or to inefficient ones, he says, but there it would be societies that adopt labor-intensive tools. In the book I talk about, right, the distinction between tools that want to do stuff for us, like streaming music on Spotify or prompting ChatGPT, versus tools that demand virtue and disciplines on our part, right, like playing an instrument or writing an essay. And so you can see, right, it's not just a distinction between low-tech and high-tech. You can use, I mean, a violin is a very high-tech instrument. You can use a computer to write an essay. But the difference is, like, does it demand disciplines and work on my part? And hence also give me the ability to exercise my own freedom and responsibility as I relate with others? Or does it promise to just offload everything and do the work for me?
The funny thing is, Jeff, I was going to try to avoid the dumb classicist joke and say, is this the same as, you know, the Greek symbiosis, which would be living together?
Yeah.
But it sounds like, I mean, that's pretty much what you're talking about. Some of our tools really do operate with us rather than in our stead.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, very good. Well, the books matter starts with a technological boom in print technology sometime in the mid-19th century. So like any technological acceleration, new forms of human life and human community become possible in its wake. But the boom also does certain kinds of damage. You know, as Neil Postman famously said, that every new technology is a Faustian bargain. So what kinds of damage are you concerned with in this book?
Yeah, I talk about several different areas, I guess. I mean, I talk a little bit about the kinds of religious fracturing that happen, spurred in part by the Second Great Awakening, but then also by the new communication technologies that enable each denomination and sub-denomination to promulgate its, you know, doctrinal systems. You see it also in the realm of science. There's so much sort of quack medicine or pseudoscientific ideas that spread like wildfire. I mean, if you think about it, like seances and magnetism are very popular. And, you know, it's hard to distinguish between, again, right, like quack scientist stuff in the 19th century and what's being discovered about, say, electricity. I mean, electricity or magnetism do seem kind of spooky. And so a lot of these periodicals or these books that are getting published that are popular, like, now we can talk to the dead and here's how we do it. And then I focus a lot on the politics too, which of course eventually leads to the Civil War. And I think there's different ways of sort of unpacking the effects of an information explosion and how information abundance sometimes actually makes it more difficult to discern and seek the truth. But I think one way of understanding what's going on is that as communication drastically improves, people become more intimately aware of disagreements and of how wrong other people are, whether it's, again, scientific or religious or political. One of the first mass mailings happens in the 1830s when a bunch of Northern abolitionists send these abolition pamphlets throughout the South, and there's just rioting all over the place. And it kind of sets off this pamphlet war, newspaper war, book war, where the Southerners are sending stuff north about how awesome slavery is. The Northerners are, you know, spreading about how terrible it is. But everyone is keenly aware that, hey, I'm a fellow citizen with people who have like really bad beliefs about slavery. It's sort of like, maybe I hope you don't have this problem, but, you know, if you have a crazy cousin or an uncle or something with weird political views, if you just talk to this person once every three or four times a year, it's fine. You can have a normal conversation. But if every day you see some stupid post on Facebook, then you can't avoid how annoying this person's politics are. So the differences that exist before become unavoidable, I guess.
Jeff, you just explained why I unfollowed most of my family on Facebook. So that kind of outed me there. But
hypothetically.
Yeah. Of course. Now, I want to do a little bit more background work before we get into these 19th century writers in particular. Listeners who remember Christian Humanist Bingo all the way back when people were joking about that know that a lot of players' cards had a square or two dedicated to Alistair MacIntyre. So, like I said, before we get into those 19th century writers, talk for a moment about reading as technique versus reading as practice. What are some of the important differences between communal and instrumental reading?
Yeah, Nathan, you're making me nostalgic now. I think I mentioned I was just corresponding with Michael Farmer, and I never got super into podcasts, but I certainly listened to a lot of episodes of Christian Humanist.
So well, thank you, sir.
Yeah. But I think MacIntyre's distinction between internal goods and external goods is definitely apt here. Some goods are internal to the practice, and you can only enjoy them by participating in the practice. And other goods are the external ones, and you could satisfy them somewhere else. If you're just trying to get information, say, or just trying to be amused or something. Well, then if a different tool can accomplish this better, then you might as well just switch tools. And part of my point in making that distinction between technique and practice is to try to head off a kind of simplistic nostalgia that thinks if we could just go back to 1950s, or if you could just go back to 1840s, or like you pick your year, then we would have the technological conditions that would enable us to cultivate healthy communities and read and write well. I love Neil Postman. I obviously cite him quite a bit, but I do think sometimes Postman has this kind of nostalgia for 19th century. Like, well, you know, people back then read poorly too. A lot of people were reading bad things in bad ways. So I guess the point is poor reading is a human problem before it's a technological problem. And hence the wisdom of the past about how to address these human problems continues to apply in our new technological milieu.
Right. Now, Jeff, I implied a promise that I'm actually not going to keep. One more thing before we get to Emerson. talk to our listener for a moment about Jeff Bilbro's 26 Theses. So listeners probably already suspect that this has some relationship with Martin Luther. So talk about why that they are theses rather than axioms or mitzvoth or algorithms or something else.
Yeah. My goal, it is an unusual, the publisher humored me when I wanted to include these, but my idea was, and I cite Luther, I cite some others. The goal is claims that provoke, like seeing these not as assertions that are, I'm going to prove fully, but as the beginning places for a conversation. And Luther's famous 95 Theses were designed, I think the historical record is a little bit unclear, but probably he never did actually have an oral disputation. But the genre is designed to, you publish these, people think about them, and then you have a debate about them, right? And that's kind of what I'm going for. So the idea is to make these provocative statements that at the beginning kind of spark ideas, disagreements, questions, but also helps to stake out some of my commitments that guide the more typical evidence-based scholarly analysis that follows. So I try to say things that I think are true, but also say them in a way that's extreme or the most kind of pointed way I can think of to frame them.
Makes some good sense. And listeners, I'll go ahead and say that you're going to have to get the book to read the 26 Theses. I'm not going to recite them here. And Jeff,
I hope you have memorized them. That's good. Them.
Yeah. You are free to refer to them as we go along, but okay. I'm going to be mainly talking about these 19th century writers because I don't know if I told you. I don't think I told you off air today. I might have told you before, but in my new high school position, I am teaching American literature for the first time since 2005. So these are some writers that I am re-encountering for the nice. First time in a good long time. So let's get to Emerson, shall we? I'll confess that when I teach Emerson's address to the Harvard Divinity School or his essay Self-Reliance, I tend to focus on his antipathy to folks who draw their ideas out of books, but you make the claim in this book that his individualism is a product of print culture. So what light does Emerson's individualism shed on American Protestant Bible piety?
Yeah, and I try to have a caveat, I think. I hope I have a caveat at the beginning of the Emerson chapter, that I am sort of zeroing in on one aspect of Emerson's thought. You know, if consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds, I don't want to accuse Emerson of being consistent always. So I do think he's got some interesting things to say elsewhere, but I'm trying to focus on one element of his thought that I think is problematic or troubling and reveals some dangerous assumptions that do arise out of print culture. And yeah, as you say, in particular, American Protestant print culture. And in particular, you know, I zero in on this bizarre image at the beginning of nature where he imagines himself as a transparent eyeball kind of elevated above the plane and forgetful of his past and his body and able to see and penetrate all and partake of, be part and parcel of God. And I think that image, right, of the eye that sees all and is not refracted by its past or its community or its body is in some ways a distillation of the ideal of the Protestant reader of the Bible, that you can just, you know, through this book, each individual can go back to the primitive church and encounter God directly, right? The kind of extreme version of sola scriptura that none of the magisterial reformers would endorse. But yet going back and encountering God directly. So Emerson has this real impatience for mediation, whether it's community or the body or tradition. And I think that's part of why in his sermon about the Lord's Supper, where he's giving up the pulpit, he's like, I don't need this Lord's Supper ritual thing to encounter God because I can just encounter God directly. I don't need Jesus' body and blood. So yeah, that's that's his sort of impatience with mediation and his conviction that through print he can access truth. And then, you know, a lot of people have noted this at the end of Nature and other places too. He has these kind of remarkable passages about once you have this direct access to God, then some kind of, quote, correspondent revolution in things will occur. And he lists all these things that will go away, like pigs, spiders, snakes, prisons.
Right.
Right. Which I love, because then Hawthorne at the beginning of Scarlet Letter says, here's a prison. Deal with this, Emerson. So yeah, Emerson thinks, right, that if we can really have direct access, then we can remake reality in this image that we have manufactured. But I think, obviously, that's a kind of dangerous arrogance.
I want to press on this a little bit, because in the minds of, you know, more recent writers, and I'm thinking mid-20th century writers like Francis Schaeffer, there is a world of difference between a sort of biblical authority on one hand and, you know, what Schaeffer, you know, famously or infamously calls secular humanism on the other hand. But you are saying that the two are a lot more alike than they'd prefer to say. So say a little bit more about that.
Now, that's interesting, Nathan. Maybe, so you're saying maybe for all of his kind of anti-Christianity or yet his sort of humanism, Emerson is still in some ways a creature of Protestant hermeneutics.
Well, I mean, you put them in the chapter together. You tell
me. Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I'm just making sure I get your question. Absolutely. I think absolutely.
That's on me, Bill, bro.
Sorry. I was making sure I follow the question. No, I think you're right. That that while Emerson is sort of, oh, I don't know, ashamed of his more pietistic neighbors, right?
Certainly.
He still has very similar hermeneutic posture toward the world. So yeah, I definitely see him as a creature of the very religious culture that he is critiquing, and in some ways then kind of bound to some of its worst deformations because of the ways that he's trying to react against it.
Very good. I want to stick with Bibles for a moment, because you claim two things about printed English Bibles that seem to contradict each other, but I want you to paint them into the same picture together. On one hand, printed Bibles crystallize theological differences, but on the other, they become what you call therapeutic consumables. And I mean, if I think about therapy or if I think about consumerism, neither one of those necessarily makes me think about doctrinal dispute.
Yeah.
So how do these two sides of printed Bibles fit together?
That's a great question. And maybe I should have been clear, or maybe I want to say that they're kind of consecutive, the sort of sequential developments.
Okay.
Because I do think, yeah, at first, print makes the theological or doctrinal or cultural differences more obvious by fixing them in print and spreading them around, you know, so different places and traditions can directly encounter the words and the systems of others. You know, Elizabeth Eisenstein and other kind of critics of the print culture have pointed out that in the late medieval church, there are all these different theologies existing kind of in solution. And then during the Reformation process, fueled by you know, this burgeoning of theological print, all the different traditions have to kind of systematize their own thinking and differentiate, you know, them from the Catholics or the Anabaptists or the Lutherans or the Calvinists or the Anglicans, so that the incompatibility between these different systems becomes unavoidable. So that's what I mean by kind of crystallizing the doctrinal or theological differences. And then I think maybe kind of following on that, as then people come to understand themselves in contradistinction to other traditions or other denominations, then each kind of group and subgroup wants to have its own book. I mean, a classic example, right, is Thomas Jefferson, who like remakes the New Testament in his image of who Jesus should be, and then uses that bolderized version for his daily devotions, daily meditations on how to be a moral person, right? And throughout the 19th century, then as printing becomes cheaper, it goes from being like everyone's going to read the same version of the Bible and there's like, you know, no different kinds of notes. And now every denomination has their own commentaries or their own notes or their own bindings or their own formats. I mean, there's riots, right, that happen in the North over the distinctions between, is this, are we giving our students Catholic Bibles or Protestant Bibles? And then today, of course, now we have the Green Bible or the Patriots Bible that includes the Constitution or the Woman's Bible or the Man's Bible or the, you know, every kind of identity group you can imagine has their own Bible marketed to them. And I think the result is that we come to see the Bible as a book for me as an individual rather than a book to the people of God.
Right. That makes some good sense. I want to shift from Bibles to maps because your book's chapter on cartography as a site of change definitely rang a bell for me. Even listeners who have watched some of the Pirates of the Caribbean sequels have taken in a scene reflecting on what changes when the, you know, the West India Company turns the world into a grid. But we're not talking about Captain Jack. We're talking about Captain Ahab. What does Ahab have to show us about the ways that our maps shape our imagination?
Yeah, I had a lot of fun with this and kind of went down a rabbit trail in my research. A lot of it didn't end up in the book. But the history of maps and the development of maps absolutely parallels print, right? As people can print maps and replicate them exactly, then sailors are taking these with them and correcting them. So it absolutely spurs this revolution and improvement in cartography. I do focus on, as you talk about, Ahab's maps. And just as Melville is publishing Moby Dick, this retired, or I guess not retired, I think he got injured. So he's a naval lieutenant or something who's stationed in D.C. now, Lieutenant Maury. And he collates all of the data from the ship's logs and creates this grid over the oceans. And he's got color codes and all kinds of symbols so that whaling captains can identify when and where the different species of whales are most likely to be found. I think the version of the book is kind of grayscale, but if you look online at the archives, you can find like it's got pinks and blue. It's really amazing. And I think it's like, you know, you should see it as a kind of precursor to today's maps built with, you know, big data that allows us to map things like voting patterns and which swing districts, you know, how, which five votes do we need to swing to flip the seat, or, you know, or things like disease outbreaks, or I don't know, like which homeowners are going to be more likely to fall behind their payments. You know, just whatever information you want to organize, right? You can overlay it on the map and get control of the situation. And clearly Ahab uses this map to try to, I don't know, carry out his quest against this evil vision of who God is. But I think maps like this, these kinds of charts, tempt us to put ourselves in this panopticon bird's eye position and then control reality to fit our desires, right? They tempt us to act like God. And as Ahab demonstrates, this is quite dangerous when our desires are selfish or perverted in some fashion.
Right. And I mean, one example that always occurs to me is, I mean, in so many productions of Shakespeare's King Lear that I've seen, Act One, Scene One is staged in a map room.
Yep.
Right. Which I mean, I can imagine something like that happening.
Yep.
You know, maybe not on a thrust stage like the Globe, but maybe in something like the Blackfriars, where, you know, I mean, you actually do have maps to which they point as they divide up, you know, Lear's kingdom, which of course would have been, you know, completely beyond the horizons of their imagination during. Yeah.
It's anachronistic.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely.
But it shows what's going on very well, yeah.
Well, Ahab, I figured, might be a villain in this story. I'll confess that I didn't anticipate seeing Walt Whitman conscripted to play the bad guy, but here we are. So what features of Leaves of Grass and what special edition printings of Leaves of Grass make Whitman a forerunner of the social media influencer? And who in the world thinks that Whitman is a totalitarian poet
Yeah, I think my colleague Paige would ask this question. I have some colleagues and friends who take issue with my reading of Whitman. So it is what it is. I have my opinions. Yeah. But I see Whitman as a kind of forerunner for the Insta poets, and this person who's trying to establish a kind of faux, or I call it asymmetric, intimacy with his readers. And it is absolutely fascinating how many of his promotional techniques prefigure those used today. I mean, he kind of pioneers. He's certainly not the first person to use an author photograph, but he pioneers and develops the possibilities, even to the extent where one of his early photographs, he does the 19th century version of Photoshop to expand the size of his groin and like accentuate his manhood. It's quite remarkable.
Readers, there's more details on that in the book.
That's right. All the details, yeah. He also is the first one to use a blurb. In his case, he doesn't get permission, right? He sends the book to Emerson. Emerson writes him a nice letter back in private. And Whitman takes one line out of context and slaps it on the spine of the next issue of the book. And of course, Emerson is quite miffed at this. Partly because he doesn't want to be associated with publicly with Whitman's sort of edgy verses. But he also writes, Whitman also writes unsigned reviews of his own books. So he's very innovative with the technologies of the day and tries to, and the print culture of the day, and tries to make himself popular.
Let me follow up on that real quick, because when I first learned Whitman in the mid to late 1990s, you know, the way that my professor taught it was that, you know, Whitman was a kind of post-transcendentalist mystic, that this connection with the readers was something that was metaphysical rather than technological. And he wouldn't even phrase it that way. It was simply metaphysical. But you're arguing that, I mean, you know, this is part of an advertising machine.
Exactly. And no, I mean, I take your point that you can certainly see this as flowing from his philosophy. But it is, he was very concerned about sales and popularity, and, you know, making his book. For instance, he always wants his books to be small, or not always. He has some that are more special editions, but often when he's corresponding with the publisher, he's like, I want it to be handy. I want it to fit in the pocket so people can carry it with me. I want it to be cheap so everyone can have a copy. I mean, he has this longing for kind of mass saturation of the market, which eventually, by the end of his life, he pretty much succeeds in. It helps that he has his big court case about obscenity. That was key in his popularity.
Well, sure. I mean, you know,
the
adage that all publicity is good publicity. it's older than sometimes we think.
Yeah.
Now, I will confess, if you asked me to name a book from the 19th century that really did have totalitarian leanings, I'd pick Mark Twain's A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court. So I know that it tries to undermine Hank's adoration of revolutionary violence, but I'm not sure it gets that far. But you focus on some oddities in the book that I didn't spend much time thinking about when I last read it more than 20 years ago. So tell us about magic in this book and Sandy's influence on Hank, and how all of this leads us to complicate the ways that we treat printed words as holy objects.
Yeah, I think you need to reteach this book to your high school students. I'm sure they would like it. When I teach this, we always have debates, you know, about the relationship between the narrator, Hank Morgan, and the author, Twain. And if you read the criticism, the secondary criticism, I think many, if not most critics, do more or less identify Twain with Hank. And so they see the ending as like, I don't know, kind of like, you know, Twain didn't realize where this is going, and whoa, that was unexpected, this explosion. But I think, and obviously this is my argument, and I'm not the only one who argues this, that there's a clear gap between Hank Morgan and Mark Twain. and that Twain is using Morgan to try to draw in readers' sympathy, help them see, oh, this is a modern American. He's a Yankee. He cares. He thinks technology will improve the world. He's a Democrat. You know, he's going to spread. He's going to overthrow monarchy in England. This is great. And then when you see where that leads Twain, you see the absurd, horrifying violence, that the crazy, tyrannical means to which he resorts, you realize, oh, maybe techno-optimism and this colonial impulse to spread democracy is a lot more dangerous than I thought. So part of the argument, right, is that Twain has this habit of creating flawed protagonists like Tom Sawyer. And part of it is more specific to the book, where there's these, he's in particular paralleled to Morgan Le Fay, right? His name is similar, mm-hmm. Who's a bad lady. And yet the narrator, Hank Morgan, actually is in some ways more vindictive than Morgan. There's this great scene where the band is playing and plays the song poorly. And so Morgan's going to hang the composer. And then after Hank hears the song again, he's like, nope, let's just hang the whole band. So he's fine with this kind of violence. And then also he's contrasted with Merlin, right, who is a magician, but he uses like hocus pocus magic, and Hank Morgan uses technological magic. In particular, as you mentioned, his newspaper. I mean, Hank thinks, he talks about the newspaper as this dark work of enchantment that will kind of magically spread democracy and truth, even though nobody pretty much can read English. So it doesn't have a very big audience. And then by the end of the book, he is hanging authors who publish things he doesn't like. Of course, he kills tens of thousands of people in the name of democracy. So he's, I think, this sort of warning lesson that you might begin with really good intentions, but if you are willing to impose your values and your vision of freedom and democracy and technology and print upon other people through violence, this is going to lead some pretty dark places.
Yeah, and like I said, it's been 20 years since I've read this novel, but talk a little bit about the passages where Hank is praising the terror, because I feel like, you know, when he praises the terror,
that's true.
I mean, that for me, and again, I'm relying on old memories here.
No, you're right.
But that's where, I mean, the distinction that you're talking about between Hank Morgan and Samuel Clemens.
Correct.
Gets a little bit thin for my comfort.
Correct. That's a great point. Wow, you have a good memory for 20 years ago. Yes, when Hank is, you know, declaiming against the excesses of the French monarchy, he's very anachronistic. So he sort of collapses all the problems of aristocracy from like 6th century Britain to, 18th century, 17th century France. But I think those are certainly sincere. The way I read that is Samuel Clemens is pointing out, like, look, I don't want to go back to aristocracy or the Catholic Church telling people what to believe. But I'm also really torn because I see the same dark impulses in my Yankee neighbors. I mean, Twain or Samuel Clemens certainly is a techno-optimist himself in many ways. And I think it's significant that as he's writing this book, he's investing all of his money into this compositor that was going to sort of mechanically, automatically set type, which was kind of the last part in the printing process to be automated.
Right.
And he goes bankrupt because he picks the wrong horse. The Linotype is the better technology, and that succeeds. And so I think he sees this sort of techno-optimism in himself, but he also sees its dangers. And so I think it's a very subtle book where he's critiquing the tyranny that can take different forms. It can take a kind of oppressive hierarchical form, but it can also come under the guise of quote unquote freedom.
All right. Well, Jeff, we're going to have to accelerate because we only have an hour, but I want you to tell our listeners No, I want to tell our listeners, sorry, that this book is worth picking up and spending hours with.
I'll tell them that too.
That you raise, yeah, they really do stand as good starting points for reflection. So your idea that this is a set of theses really does work for me. But I want to go back to Moby Dick, because your book goes back to Moby Dick, and point to the segment of the book that I'd completely forgotten, a reflection on fast fish and loose fish, to talk about the isolatos in Ahab's crew and the ways that they stand allegorically, I guess, for all of us in an age of thrilling but menacing change and freedom. So, I mean, for Melville and for Bilbro, is American freedom mainly a long con, or am I reading you too cynically?
No, pretty much. I mean, this, I think, goes back to what we were just saying with Twain. I think Melville sees the dangers of both sides, right? And this is a really a small chapter in Moby Dick, but I think it's a crucial chapter. I mean, I think in some ways the best way I can say this is how I try to put it. I think this is like thesis 18 or something, where I say that atomization, or kind of negative freedom, right, can liberate individuals from diseased communities, but its atomizing effects are like the toxins of chemotherapy, right? So it's better than cancer sometimes, but it's not in and of itself healthy. And I think this is how Melville sees negative freedom. Like, his basic point in this argument about whaling laws and kind of a might makes right law on the ocean is that in a modern liberal society, despite this kind of patina that we have, that we're all free and equal before the law, more often than not, it's those with money and it's those with power that find ways to benefit themselves and oppress others. He has this great line too in Confidence Man that I mentioned in the introduction, where he says that where the wolves are killed off, the foxes increase. So you might think about the wolves as like the Pope or the King, or, you know, some sort of oppressive hierarchy. Okay, you get rid of those and everyone's free, and then you're going to be vulnerable to the con men or the capitalists down the street. So it's, I guess you got to, you know, two steps forward, two steps back. I think the ideal, well, we can talk about this more in the last section, but the ideal is a kind of actual robust freedom in community rather than freedom from all kinds of community.
That makes some sense. And I mean, I think it also goes along with, you know, what you link up with technological innovation, and what, you know, Nathan Hatch in his book, The Democratization of American Christianity, links up with more of a, you know, a zeitgeist, right? An idea that was taking over the continent. And I think, honestly, I mean, the more of your book I read, the more I could see it in conversation with Nathan Hatch's work, because I think that the ideas and the technology are definitely, well, symbiotic, to go back to a word that we talked about earlier.
100%. I mean, I think what Hatch is describing in Religion was super influential for me in trying to make sense of these dynamics. Yeah.
Very good. Very good. Well, if Whitman as the Instagram villain surprised me, Thoreau as the hero of liberal arts surprised me even more. So I'll go ahead and voice my suspicion here, Jeff. I've only read Walden a couple of times, and the last time I read it was when I was a grad student, you know, about 20 years ago. But when I remember his section on reading mainly ancient books rather than girly sentimental novels, I tend to take that just as a bit of good old New England misogyny. But you find other things here, and you're our guest here. So tell our listeners about Thoreau as the champion of serious reading.
Good. Yeah, I mean, you're right. I think that question, that chapter has its foibles. But I don't know if you noticed, but last year Oxford's word of the year was brain rot, which is a term that Thoreau uses in Walden to describe.
Does he really? I didn't remember that. Okay,
that's his. He coins it.
I spend all day with 16-year-olds, so
you know brain rot.
I never hear that term.
So, I mean, I think what he says about brain rot is really apropos. He has this other great metaphor that I draw on for a different chapter from Life Without Principle, where he talks about how if you habitually attend to trivia, you macadamize your intellect, which is like a kind of road technology that just uses bits of gravel. So it's like your whole brain turns into fragments and you can't sustain a thought. So that's where he's coming from, I think, in Walden, when he's advocating deep reading, slow reading, hard reading. I mean, he says books must be read as deliberately and reservedly as they are written. But what I think is wonderful about Walden is, and again, you know, maybe you disagree with me, that he doesn't take himself too seriously. So he has this long chapter on, I only read old books. You got to read very carefully. And then he follows it with this chapter on, I spend my days listening to the sounds of the birds and the animals and only attending to things that are oral and present. Or he's got this chapter on like higher spiritual laws and I should probably become a vegetarian. And then he's like, yeah, but sometimes I wanted to eat a woodchuck and there's something really important about my animal neighbors. So he goes back and forth. And I think near the end of the book, he's got this great line about he wanting to speak extravagantly, like wanting to stretch our imaginations or our categories. And I think, yeah, so I tend to read him fairly, taking himself lightly and trying to expand our imaginations and help us to entertain new possibilities. So he can be kind of a curmudgeon, but I think it's endearing in some ways.
But I recognize so a common thread I'm hearing here, Jeff, is that I might have read these things when I was too young and I was taking them too seriously.
Yeah. You got to teach them to your high school students now.
All right. I'll see what I can do. There's a whole lot of other things that I've got to do in a high school year, but we'll see what I can do. Now, a hero of the book that I fully anticipated would be a hero is Emily Dickinson. And in your chapter on her poetry, you present possibilities for resisting commercial media economies and opening yourself to God through poetic contemplation. But for the sake of our skeptical listeners, and I mean me, what are the strong ethical differences between Dickinson's I Dwell in Possibility and Whitman's I Contain Multitudes? Again, when I first studied these folks seriously, I was in my early to mid-20s as an undergrad first and then as a grad student. I might have just been too young, but those two seem pretty similar to me.
Man, you have an incredible memory. I wish I remember what I read when I was 20. That's a great question. Because T.S. Eliot has this line in, I don't know, Little Gidding maybe, where he says that things that look alike yet differ completely, these things that flourish in the same hedgerow, but we have to distinguish between them.
And that and to sounds me, like T.S. Eliot.
Yeah. to me, this is one of those things where it sounds very similar, but I see them as a kind of mirror images of one another. So Dickinson's eye is this effort to sympathize with or understand or imagine different perspectives while recognizing they're different and leaving them as different, right? Not trying to collapse them together. And Whitman's poetic eye wants to kind of conscript all of these different things, the Northerners, the Southerners, the Easterners, the Westerners, or the men, the women, all of them have to be like smooshed together and contained in himself. So Whitman is trying to forge differences into some system or unit, and Dickinson is trying to inhabit them, but not necessarily systematize them, I guess. And I think that stems from her base, or is related to her basic concern that led her not to publish very many of her poems, because she was concerned that participating in the print marketplace at all, much less like Whitman trying to dominate it, would reduce the complexity of herself, right? She was worried that it would kind of turn her into an avatar or a brand or something, a kind of simplified version of her full analog self. And so she wanted her poems to be gifts that her friends could enjoy, but not commodities that she would sell. I think their different views of the self are actually run consistently through their poems and then also through their approach to how they participated or not in the print marketplace.
That makes some sense. Now, I mean, to follow up on that, I mean, one of the things that Dickinson, I mean, let me try to make the devil's advocate case here.
Please.
When she colonizes the dead, which seems like the ultimate act of colonization, I mean, Is she that far from Whitman when she hears a fly buzz when she dies? When you and I, Jeff, know full well she was entirely alive when she wrote that one.
Well, maybe it was a seance. No, I take that point. I mean, I think, again, I would just say what she's trying to do is imagine and put herself in that place and fully enter into another perspective, which is different than, and so in other words, to dwell in possibility, even these extravagant or extreme possibilities, which is different than in a Whitmanian line, sort of crushes or smushes all of these differences into one. I mean, again, I like some, I think his poem like Crossing Brooklyn Ferry is wonderful, or like When Lilacs Last by Dooryard Bloom's, his poems to Lincoln are wonderful. But it's the kind of the Song of Myself where like everything has to be subordinated to and unified in me that I think betrays a kind of, yeah, totalitarian eye.
All right. When we get towards the end of your book, I ran into a name that honestly I have heard a few places, but I've never spent any time studying seriously. So talk to our listeners a little bit about Margaret Fuller. You write about her endeavors with lyceums and little magazines, and it seems like both of those are renewing and bringing new kinds of conviviality into a reading public that had become atomized, to use your term.
Yep.
So talk to our listeners and talk to me about Margaret Fuller, because this seems like a name that I should become more familiar with.
Yeah, I think the tragedy part of the tragedy, I mean, she died young in a shipwreck. So that's part of the tragedy of her life. But also like,
that sounds tragic.
Yeah. Her books, you know, she only wrote a couple books and then a lot of essays, and they're of uneven quality. I mean, I think, yeah, they're okay. But what she was really good at, apparently, was guiding and steering these conversations. And that's a more ephemeral art, right? So it's harder for us to access that. I do think it's fascinating that in her books, especially I talk about Summer in the Lakes, she tries to kind of recreate this conversational style in print. And a lot of her essays do this as well. So you can kind of get a sense of how her mind works. I think it's quite remarkable. But yeah, she saw her efforts as an editor, whether at the Transcendentalist Dial or then for Greeley's New York Tribune, she saw that as an opportunity to stage a thoughtful conversation for readers to encounter, right? So she's not trying to tell them, think this. She's trying to say, you know, ask these questions. I mean, she goes back, she rereads Plato all the time and talks about how she's trying to model her art on sort of Socratic questioning. So yeah, whether it's in her editing work, in these conversations that she would host in Boston, you can kind of think about it like a sort of lifelong learning, or yeah, a lyceum. I mean, maybe she would have been a great podcaster.
There you go.
Right. Or then also her her efforts to help normal people, not academics, you know, wrestle with big ideas. What I like about her is that she's not trying to set herself up as a guru that's dispensing, you know, prepackaged wisdom. Here's my TED talk. Here's my, you know, secret, sign up for the secret thing and it will give you all the life hacks you need to live your best life now. She's inviting people into the hard work of thinking and of asking hard questions and of wrestling with them together. And so I really admire that kind of mode of discourse that she's trying to foster.
Very good. And like I said, I mean, you know, this strikes me, and I'm entirely borrowing this from my friend Chris Pipkin. We used to be professors together, and he notes that really until the early 19th century, you don't have literature that is distinctively Christian literature, because before then, there's not really a secular movement in culture that's trying to push against Christianity. And then this reminds me of it because it strikes me that, you know, a lot of the things she's after, we could recognize as, you know, the liberal education that, you know, medieval universities and even to a greater extent, you know, the Renaissance humanists were after. But in the 19th century, when you have dime novel culture, this becomes a lot more interesting precisely because it's got something to push against.
Exactly. So she's appealing to these women. I mean, she mostly, all of her conversations were with women, and she's saying like, don't, you know, don't just follow the easy stuff the publishers are foisting on you. You too are capable of asking and wrestling with these big ideas. So I think it's a good way of sort of recognizing her significance, or what kind of the new edge that it takes on in the context of mass print.
Right, right. Now, I'm not sure what direction I want to go with your discussion of Hawthorne, so I'll let you choose. Do you want to talk to our listeners about Roger Chillingworth as the sinister version of the Prophet Nathan, and explain to me how the prophet who later cons the dying David into backing young Solomon for the throne is the paradigm of true friendship? Or do you want to talk about the relationships between fiction's ambiguities and the ways that they stand athwart cancel culture? These are two directions I never anticipated in a chapter on Nathaniel Hawthorne. So if you can somehow weave these two together, I will be truly impressed.
You ask such great questions. Well, look, like, you can't cancel your namesake. Like, the Prophet Nathan's a good dude. You know, but look, by First Kings.
No, the Prophet Nathan is a snake.
We're going to have to talk about
I also read his story all the way into First Kings. So,
well, I know. Look, by that point, David is totally senile. The kingdom is on the verge of anarchy. And Nathan is conning David for David's own good. Like, the good of the kingdom.
Those are some dangerous waters, Jeff.
Okay, fair enough. I'm not sure manipulation is ever great. But I don't talk about it. Yeah, Hawthorne is focused on the early Nathan conversation with David.
There we go. I can live with that. I can live with that.
We'll have this discussion about the later Nathan later. I think what's fascinating is, you know, both Hawthorne and Melville are obsessed with ambiguity and indeterminacy and the challenges of, you know, assigning meaning, symbols, etc. And oftentimes those are sources of frustration, right? Like the Protestant hermeneutic, you know, think about like Charles Hodge or the sort of clear and distinct ideas. Like, we just, like, the Bible needs to mean one thing. And what Hawthorne is getting at in Scarlet Letter, I'm arguing, is that ambiguity in the context of trust and a relationship and a narrative that's going somewhere can become an opportunity for correction and clarification and redemption. So yeah, ambiguity in the context of distrust or antagonism is often the grounds for manipulation or sort of selfish conniving. Mm-hmm. But without ambiguity, you can't have the possibility of a kind of redemption or eucatastrophe that would re-signify the events of our life. So in Scarlet Letter, famously, there's this A.
That gets... I was going to say, it's been too long since I read this. Yeah. I thought it was A.
I'm saying Hester, and then I'm just putting an H.
Yeah. Oh, gotcha. Gotcha.
The A on Hester. and right, everyone thinks it means adulterer or adulteress, and it does. But over the course of the novel, it also comes to mean things like able or maybe art or angel. Mm. Right. And it's not that she is no longer an adulteress. It's not that Hawthorne is saying like, oh, her sin never happened. But that one act of sin, that one sin, is not definitive of her entire character. And I think that's what Nathan is doing when he confronts David as well. Right. He's not saying, you have done this horrible thing and that now defines you. He's saying, wow, you've done some horrible things, David. But you also love God. You're also a poet. You have this innate sense of justice. And if you can just recognize yourself in this parable I'm going to tell you, in the story I'm going to tell you, you will recognize that you have done wrong. And, your desire to follow God and be obedient can lead you to repentance and reformation. So I think we all need friends, right, that will see us not for our worst acts, but as the complicated people we are. And will walk with us on our journey of sanctification.
I want to come back to ambiguity for a moment, because one of the things that I often find myself saying, and I think this might be a product of becoming an old man, I'm not sure, is that the incentive structures, especially of social media, but of political culture more broadly in 2025, punishes ambiguity and punishes complexity and rewards a very ardent simplicity. Yeah. And I would say often a reductionist simplicity. Am I just spending too much time online, Jeff, or is that something that you see as more pervasive than just the online culture?
I mean, yes, you probably are spending too much time online. But no, I think you're exactly right. And what I think is fascinating about Hawthorne is that he shows how like ambiguity in the context of either the solitary individual self or the kind of naked public is often a problem, right? Like for the self, we just avoid our sin and we just, you know, we are very self-serving in the way that we remake ambiguity. But yeah, I mean, the whole thing with the scaffold in Scarlet Letter is about how ambiguity becomes an occasion for reductive and quite vindictive punishment. So what Hawthorne is gesturing to is we need these places of friendship, of trust, right? Against like the Nathan David example, really Hester's sort of tragedy is that she has no friends. Dimmesdale's tragedy, right? He has no friend except Chillingworth. And so we need friends that will help us sort through ambiguity and use it redemptively. And I think that's exactly what the online culture is lacking, right? It's always public. It's always a performance for your tribe. And so in that context, yeah, ambiguity is never going to be positive.
That makes sense. I don't like it much, but it makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, Jeff, I've been at the wheel for most of this conversation, so in the spirit of hospitality, I'm going to let you have the last word. What do you want our listeners thinking about communication technology, American literature, or whatever else as we head for the door?
Yeah, I mean, you just said, I don't like it. And I mean, that's often my response as I'm thinking through these things. Wow, I don't like how things are. I wish it was different. And I think most people looking out recognize that our social, informational, technological ecosystem is pretty dysfunctional. But my hope in this project is kind of twofold. One, to see that these problems aren't radically new, that humans have always been tempted to use technologies in ways that control others and satisfy our selfish desires. And so maybe that can give us a little bit of hope. And then also recognize and think about how we might seek out the possibilities for good work that remain. Like we can still, even in this context, cultivate in ourselves and our students, our families, our churches, the virtues or the disciplines that we need to use the tools that we have today in more convivial ways, in ways that serve the life and the flourishing of our neighbors. So my hope is that we'll learn not to look to technology for solutions or think that it's all determined and nothing good can happen, but rather that we will look for the kinds of practices or the disciplines that will help us journey together with friends toward truth.
Jeff Bilbro, thank you for joining us on Christian Humanist Profiles.
Thank you, sir.
Listeners, thank you for downloading and listening in. The book is Words for Conviviality from Baylor University Press. Christian Humanist Profiles is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our audio editor is Britt Stack, and I'm Nathan Gilmore saying, go in grace, go in peace, serve the Lord.